You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, Stuart Purvis and Oscar Guardiola Rivera will join me to discuss the biggest stories of the day, from Venezuela to Ukraine. We'll also ask whether anyone should believe Newsweek when it says it's found the founder of Bitcoin, when the man himself denies it.
Okay, I'm not involved in Bitcoin. Okay.
Who's involved in
Bitcoin? Wait a minute. I want free lunch first. I'm going to go with this guy. I'm not in Bitcoin.
Later in the show, we'll explore the limits of collective memory in Spain with Jeremy Treglown, author of the book Franco's Crypt, Spanish Culture and Memory Since 1936. Also ahead...
I love you.
I love you. She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
This was also when I met Agatha.
She's charming. She's so charming.
Is he flirting with you?
Yes.
We will tell you if you should go to see Wes Anderson's latest film in our weekly cinema review. All that plus the latest news from Denmark with our correspondent there, Michael Booth. That's all ahead on a jam-packed episode of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in the next 60 minutes here on the programme. Before we get started, let's catch up with the latest world news. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Russia has today accused the European Union of taking an extremely unconstructive position by freezing talks on easing visa barriers between Russia and the EU. With the European Union pressing for a negotiated solution to the crisis in Ukraine, Moscow has also set out tough conditions it indicated the West must take to win Russia's cooperation. The most serious East-West confrontation since the end of the Cold War escalated when Crimea's parliament decided they will vote on whether to join Russia. The region's government set a referendum for 9 days' time. Well, President Putin revealed that he told US President Barack Obama that Ukraine's new leaders had imposed what he called illegitimate decisions on the eastern, southeastern, and Crimea regions. For his part, President Obama said there were some simple demands.
Let international monitors into all of Ukraine, including Crimea, to ensure the rights of all Ukrainians are being respected, including ethnic Russians. Begin consultations between the government of Russia and Ukraine with the participation of the international community. And the world should support the people of Ukraine as they move to elections in May.
Well, the British Prime Minister David Cameron said the European Union must pressure Russia towards mediation.
We are facing the most serious crisis in Europe this century. Getting agreement from the elected leaders of 28 European nations is never easy. We've sent a clear and united message to Russia that its actions are completely unacceptable and will incur consequences.
Meanwhile, Ukraine's Paralympic chief said on Friday that his team will leave the Winter Paralympic Games if Russia invades his home country, adding that he hoped the competition would be able to spread peace instead. Other news now, and the religious mix in cities in the Central African Republic must be maintained if the extremely grave situation in the country is to be stabilised, the UN's aid chief said on Friday. Following a visit to the conflict-torn country, Valerie Amos said fewer than 1,000 Muslims were believed to remain in the capital, Bangui, and that action had to be taken fast. Upheaval in the former French colony has claimed thousands of lives since Seleka, a coalition of mostly Muslim northern rebels, seized power a year ago, and militias drawn from the majority Christian population stepped up reprisals against them. A huge demonstration has taken place in the Portuguese capital Lisbon by police and security officials angry at wide-ranging wage cuts. Portugal has had to implement the cuts to overcome the financial crisis and meet its bailout terms. But Armando Ferreira, head of the Portuguese police union, says the cuts go too far.
They already have decided that Portugal must carry on for the next 20 years with more cuts. And for that, I do not believe that things will improve. I do believe that if nothing is made, and if the police officers do not show, as they are saying, showing today, that they are unhappy, things will get worse, not better.
The German president, Joachim Gauck, has expressed his sorrow and shame on Friday for crimes committed by Nazi troops in Greece during the Second World War. Gauck was visiting Ioannina, where in October 1943, German Wehrmacht forces killed more than 90 people, including 34 children, and set fire to homes. And finally, a California man who lost $500,000 in 17 hours gambling at a Nevada casino was so drunk he couldn't remember the episode after waking up in his hotel room. A lawsuit filed on his behalf is seeking to erase the debt. Mark Johnston, who's 52, arrived drunk at the downtown Grand Casino in Las Vegas and claims he was constantly given free alcoholic drinks while he gambled. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. That makes me wonder. We've had a few bulletins from you like that, haven't we?
Oh, you are. Now, hang on a second.
No,
you could be right.
I'm joking, of course. Jonathan Wheatley, a model of professionalism at all times. Well, most times at least. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Yes, you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is just ticking towards 18.07. That's 13.07 in New York City. A very good afternoon to you if you're listening on the eastern seaboard of the US. I'm delighted to say now that joining me with their take on today's news, right here in Studio One, are Stuart Purvis, a professor of journalism at London's City University, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera from London's Birkbeck College. Gentlemen, welcome both to the show. Great to have you with us, as always. We're going to start today's show in Venezuela. At least two more people died yesterday during clashes between police and protesters, bringing the death toll to at least 20 in less than a month of unrest. The president, Nicolas Maduro, continues to claim the protests are being led by a minority, perhaps unsurprisingly, and denouncing a coup he suggests is supported by the United States. Before I get the views of Oscar and Stuart, let's have a quick listen to what Maduro himself had to say in an interview with CNN's Christiane Amanpour that aired a little earlier today.
Do you have a message for the US? There's been expelling of diplomats. You did it. They did it. Now you've nominated Mr. Max Arbeláez as your new ambassador to Washington. What do you hope to see? What is your message to the United States?
Well, my message is respect, dialogue, that we overcome the visions they have of our country. Precisely, I made a decision to appoint a new ambassador to the U.S. Don't go to a stalemate, to a blind alley regarding Venezuela and Latin America. Our message to those ruling the U.S. is respect Venezuela, respect Latin America, and let's establish new levels of relation.
So that was Maduro talking to Christiane Amanpour. In her question there, she suggested that he'd obviously named a new ambassador to the US, but also expelled Panama's ambassador, suggesting that country was America's lackey. And yet at the same time, he's saying we must not abandon dialogue. Dialogue is important. Oscar, if I can start with you, does he sound to you like a man who wants dialogue or not?
Well, we have a saying in Latin America, do speak to the owner of the circus rather than the clown. Now, I'm not suggesting too much here, but every Latin American knows that Panama has been a sovereign but intervened country since at least 1903. And it is the case that Maduro is obviously trying to open a dialogue with those whom he considers are very much behind what is happening in Venezuela. There is, of course, discontent among Venezuela. It is among Venezuelans one half of the population, less than half, if we stick to electoral results. And that discontent is also to be taken seriously. But it is clearly the case that the United States has been funding the opposition. You only have to look into the documents of the US government itself. There are 5 million earmarked for the opposition of Venezuela in this year's budget. And that is the reason why Maduro is trying to talk to them. Also, because he's absolutely right in pointing out that the only possible outcome here is a stalemate. Because, you know, best case scenario, there is half of the population who is very much against the government. Less than half again, if we stick to electoral results. And there is another half, a very, very important half, a majority in electoral terms, who is for Maduro, who elected Maduro, and who are also very much the beneficiaries of the Venezuelan revolution. And they are not going to let those benefits go, which, of course, means that things could only go worse. Having said that, we must remember that what is happening now in Venezuela must be compared, first of all, with what happened back in 2003. That was an attempted coup d'etat. It was an attempted military takeover, as acknowledged by Teodoro Petkov, a journalist who is an opposition journalist himself. And the other comparison is with 1989, the Caracazo. When the then neoliberal government had to face popular protests. Back then, in 1 week, the government killed anything in between 300 to 2,000 people and was condemned by the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights for having done so. So that little context allows us to put today's news in perspective.
Absolutely. Well, I'll ask you a bit more about the sort of nuances of what we're seeing at the moment, certainly on the streets of Caracas in a moment. But Stuart, just on that point about the sort of dialogue issue that we mentioned at the start there, do you think that America will be encouraged by the fact that he's spoken to Christian Amanpour and is making this kind of rhetoric, or do you think they'll just be unchanged? It's still fairly belligerent, and as I said, his previous rhetoric's been fairly unequivocal, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, Christian Amanpour is high profile because she's seen around the world on CNN International. She's reasonably high profile inside the States, but not as big as she is. So there is a kind of a track record here of people in trouble sending for Christian Amanpour to interview. Actually, Gaddafi gave one of his last interviews to Christian Amanpour, so maybe it's not the right thing to do, actually.
Well, you're not seriously comparing Gaddafi with Maduro.
No, I said people in trouble. People in trouble.
Well, I'm not sure he's in trouble.
Well, he's in trouble. He's not doing terribly well.
The country's in trouble, not him. And
is that a useful distinction to make, though, do you think?
The country's in trouble is very important. It's a very important distinction because the government, actually, most commentators are now saying that after a few weeks of protests, given the fact that the opposition has not made any gains, the government is becoming reinforced. And that may be also problematic because what we want to see in Venezuela is a proper dialogue between the opposition, the moderate side of the opposition, not Leopoldo López, but Capriles. Leopoldo López is not a moderate. Leopoldo López and Corina Machado are fringe members of the opposition who were part of the 2002 coup d'etat. Their agenda is called the exit, la salida. That was the name that López himself put it. They're not going for a democratic exit. That's not their aim. So if you are for democracy, and if you're critical of Maduro, what you want to see is a proper dialogue. That dialogue will not take place if, many, not most, but many in the Western media believe this is just another Ukraine. Venezuela is not Ukraine.
I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, I've read some pieces, Stuart, that have suggested that this is perhaps not getting the kind of analysis, the kind of dialogue about it, certainly in the Western media, that it would because of what's happening in Ukraine. Is there a sense, do you think, perhaps, that because Ukraine is sort of, you know, right on the doorstep of the big Western European media players, it's oil and gas involved, it's very immediate, we're looking at the future of the EU, maybe people are not neglecting this, but not giving it the kind of analysis that it should be receiving?
Well, it's certainly Venezuela's barely mentioned in the European media, certainly in the UK media at the moment, because Ukraine has been such a big story. I think actually Ukraine is going slightly down the running order now. Well, there are a number of reasons for that. But the most obvious is the geopolitical implications for Europe, for Russia, for America. There's so many that come out of the Ukrainian story. Some of those come out of the Venezuela story as well, but they're just not in proportion to the Ukraine story. But I think to pick up what Oscar said, there's an interesting question that Maduro asked in his CNN interview. He said, what would happen in the United States if a group said they were going to start something in the United States so that President Obama leaves, in other words, overthrow? And he said, surely the state would react, would use all the force that the law gives it to reestablish order. Actually, that's an interesting question and quite an interesting answer, because actually, if there were disorder on the streets of Washington, I would think that actually, you know, forces would go out to suppress it, if you like. Now, what happened in Ukraine was actually the reaction of the authorities to those, if to that disorder, was of such a proportion that it tipped over, if you like. But what's interesting then is that, if like, the democratic stamp was that the parliament met and decided, yes, actually, we want him out as well. So that's, I think, a crucial element. And I don't know enough about Venezuelan politics to know if you actually have got, is there a parliament that would meet at some point and, if you like, change its mind?
Well, there is a parliament. There is a democratically elected parliament. And most of the members of that parliament do belong to the party in government. Again, the difference is that we have in Venezuela a revolutionary party in government or a reformist party in government.
But I think, so what you're saying, from what implies from that, that actually, in a sense, the only way that Maduro could be forced out would be by an undemocratic means. That there isn't, short of a next election.
That is absolutely the case. In fact, the division between the opposition, and let's be clear here. I don't like it very much when Maduro says that this is a coup. It's not yet. I know what he's invoking. He's invoking 2002 in the minds of most Venezuelans, even 1973 in Chile. Which, you know, those lessons are very important for Venezuelans today. But in fact, if there was a coup, it was an internal coup. The fringe elements of the opposition, Machado and López, outflanking Enrique Capriles, who had reinvented himself in the previous elections as a sort of Lula-like, Brazil's Lula-like candidate, because he realized that the only democratic means to oust Maduro would be to gain the favor of that fringe of Chavistas, who are not necessarily very happy with what Maduro is doing. But unfortunately, he has been outflanked by these other radicals on his right wing, and that is very, very problematic. That's the dead end that Maduro refers to. So no, we're not going to see anything like the Ukrainian parliament, trying to oust Maduro, because in fact, parliament, democratically elected, is a parliament that is majoritarily. Part of Maduro's party.
Now, we'll touch upon Ukraine a little later in the programme and talk as well about the sort of media landscape there and the impact that that's had. But just picking up on that media idea, Stuart, you sort of alluded to it when we were discussing, send for Christian Amanpour. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of the sort of the media landscape of Venezuela, there's been talk, Maduro suggested that there needs to be a rectifying of the coverage of the crisis. Is that the kind of language that, as a newsman, fills you with some trepidation?
Yeah, I mean, we saw it in the Ukraine. We saw it in Turkey, a very good example in Turkey. You know the familiar story. Suddenly there isn't so much news. Suddenly you see kind of old documentaries or even fiction being shown instead of factual programs. I think the decision to cut off the Colombian channel, NTN24, coming into the country, I think that's a significant step, because it goes to this whole issue of, you just can't control national media. You've got a global media going on. And it's quite common now for one country to carry on cable or satellite the news services of another country. So, the famous phrase in English we talk about King Canute, where you're holding back the tide. You sense here that, here's somebody trying to hold back the tide. But there are major news organizations within Venezuela that are clearly under pressure. And that's no surprise.
And Oscar, what do you make of the landscape there? Because some people suggest that the media is fairly free. It's a fairly open system. Is that an accurate description?
There is pressure by the government on the media. There is no question about that. But of course, the reason why there is so much pressure on the media is because most of the media is anti-government. If you were to take any, pretty much any, but one of the Caracas-based newspapers, you will notice immediately that they are all anti-government, and they have been anti-government for a very long time. Now, in terms of asking for corrections, well, let us remember that the New York Times had to run a correction last week for an article that began with a statement about the only television station that regularly broadcasts voices critical of the government. As it turns out, most of the private TV stations regularly broadcast voices critical of the government. And private media has more than 90% of the TV viewing audience in Venezuela. And that, of course, has to be balanced with the fact that the state also has its own media and is trying out its version of the story. But we are not here before a case of, radical infringements of the right to freedom of expression.
Stuart, we're going to
I just think there's, we mustn't forget new media in all this, because in a sense, in many countries, we've seen the so-called Arab Spring, and certainly we've seen it in Eastern Europe as well, that Twitter, if you like, bypasses these state controls. But I noticed in Venezuela, on Twitter, pictures which people were, adding to their tweets are being blocked, and apparently that's being put down to the State Communications Corporation, which goes again to the abilities of a state where communications are effectively, technically under the control of the state to make those sort of things happen.
Just briefly, I want to talk a little bit about Cuba, obviously a very sort of complex relationship with Venezuela. And Cuba itself has agreed to reopen talks with the European Union about trying to open up trade ties. There were certain sanctions lifted 5 or 6 years ago. In terms of the Venezuelan influence, if you like, the economic influences are very strong. How would you characterise, Oscar, just briefly, the relationship between the two countries? Because there's a sense, perhaps, that there's an economic reliance on one hand and maybe some learnings about, a bit of heavy-handed dealing with dissent on the other. Again, is that an unfair characterization of what the two learn from one another?
The so-called Venecuba story is a very good example of terrible journalism. It is unfair journalism. On the one hand, because it is not the case, as Moises Naim puts it in the article that you sent us, that Cuba is sort of the puppeteer and Venezuela is the puppet. That is absolutely not the case. There is influence of Cuba in Venezuela, and there is a certain respect for Cuba, but that kind of respect for what happened in Cuba back in 59 is shared by most left-leaning governments in Latin America, not just Venezuela. And actually, if anyone is dependent on Venezuela, it's Cuba. And this is a two-way street. Actually, I'm very happy that Venezuela's choice for the left in Venezuela has chosen democracy, and I'm hopeful that that will also have a certain influence in Cuba, and perhaps that's what we're witnessing here. Cuba trying to open up negotiations with Europe, Cuba undergoing many reforms which have not been reported by the press, also vis-a-vis the United States. So it is not, as Naim portrayed, raised it, a case of Cuba being, the right behind Maduro. That is absolutely not the case. Let us remember, Moises Naim in that article does provide a disclosure. Oh, by the way, I was the director of Venezuela's bank
at least he made
in
the disclosure.
1989. Well, he should disclose the whole story. That's precisely when the Caracazo happened. And the response of that government the question to him would be, were you part of that government? They killed 2,000 people and they were condemned by the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights for human rights violations. We haven't seen anything quite like that kind of violence happening now in Venezuela, or also the kind of inflation that happened back then. This, of course, there is high inflation in Venezuela. Of course, there are some bad economic decisions. I mean, Maduro has been very poor in dealing with the exchange rate, but the economic conditions of today's Venezuela are pale in comparison to the conditions of Venezuela back when Naim and his guys were in government.
Those are the insights of Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Still with me as well is Stuart Purvis. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. When we return, we'll be looking a little bit at that bias of Russian media I mentioned. And we'll ask whether Newsweek should hire more fact checkers for its revamped print edition. Stay tuned.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks. It's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24, 25 minutes past the hour. Still with me, I'm happy to say, neither of them have fled yet. Stuart Purvis from London City University, Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck College. Now, we touched on the subject a couple of days ago, coverage of the Ukraine crisis by the TV channel Russia Today. RT, something of a gift that keeps on giving to media watchers, Stuart, in particular. I know you've been intrigued by their latest reports. They're entitled grandiosely things like debunking the lies of the West. What do you, as a seasoned newsman, make of it?
It's been wonderful watching at all kinds of bizarre ways. I mean, and of course, it's feeding YouTube. There's almost daily now, there's a presenter who on air says something which is absolutely off message. And it was one based in Washington, who effectively resigned on air. But I mean, the starting point for this is a massive business, if you like. It's not a business by any normal definition. It doesn't make any money. It costs the Kremlin a fortune. But it is, it's out there fighting the BBC. The Chinese are very big in this area as well now. Virtually every country now has to have its own kind of global news business to be counted as a serious country. Where it's particularly investing in is in America, with Larry King. Larry King, for many years, the doyen of CNN, on something called RT. You have to kind of scratch yourself. If you've ever seen the show, it kind of looks like he's CNN, actually. Nothing much has changed. You know, he hasn't changed that much. Just got a little bit older, God bless him. So that...
Very often interviewing Jerry Springer.
Yeah. But it's really quite clever in some ways. And what I think is disappointing about what's happened is that this isn't very clever. What they're doing here is old style Moscow radio. It's like, you can't, you know, this looks like the crackly voice. It's so crude because it goes to the issues. Who are those troops in the Crimea? Are they Russian troops or are they local militia? And, you know, by any normal evidence, they're clearly Russians. They don't even deny on camera that they're Russians. And yet Russia Today, or RT as it calls itself, day after day says they are the local militia. They're brilliantly armed militia. They've got every known armament known to mankind. They've got fantastic uniforms, you know. So how did they make all these uniforms? So it's just a kind of credibility just sinks through the floor. But the final point I make about it is the issue of impartiality. Remember, in the United States, there are effectively no rules about impartiality. I mean, how else would Fox News and MSNBC be as slanted as they are one way or the other? So in a sense, they've got a completely free run. But in the UK, for instance, where they are regulated for their transmissions, they have already breached the rules about actually in their Libya coverage. I cannot believe that the British regulator is not going to decide against them on their coverage of the Ukraine. So I think there's a very interesting moment to come. It's probably about 6 months' time when all the regulators have got together, where you'll suddenly see a bit of a crisis about whether RT can actually carry on in Europe.
But and yet they've got quite good traction, as you mentioned, in the US, one of the most watched foreign news channels. Does that surprise you, Oscar, that RT, or do you think people are watching it as a sort of some kind of weird pseudo entertainment rather than news?
No, I think they're taking it very seriously. The reason behind the search in places like New York, for instance, where the viewership tripled, has to do with people like Abby on doing her program there, asking the kinds of questions that you can read in the United States only in The Nation or in The Onion sometimes, or in Democracy Now on the radio, and that kind of journalism does interest a lot of people in the United States. But I would agree that kind of journalism is not well served by, interviews such as the one that we saw during the Sochi Olympics, in which the anchor woman was trying to justify the unjustifiable, all this brouhaha against gays and so on and so forth. You cannot, she was trying to say that this is just cultural multiculturalism and cultural diversity. Of course, that's nonsense, and everybody can see through the lie. That's of course, a problem. Having said that, the editor of RT yesterday published a very interesting reaction to the resignation of one of the journalists and the fact that Abby spoke on camera against the intervention. She had to accept that there are those inside RT who are going to stick to their truthfulness. And that's good.
Absolutely. Now, we've only got about a minute left, but I just very briefly must mention this bit. Bitcoin story, one of my favourites of the week. The new revived, back from the dead print version of Newsweek, a bigger report they launched with much fanfare. They found the founder of Bitcoin with one small problem. Satoshi Nakamoto says he's no idea what they're talking about. Stuart, just in brief, is this almost a joke, guaranteed to get more column inches than just the mere relaunch could ever have done?
Well, for those of us who thought Newsweek was dead in print, we now know differently, don't we? So to that extent, it's been a fantastic success, whether it's true or not. But I just love the idea, what happened in the last 24 hours. So they go to this house, a pretty modest house in California. He wants to go off and do an interview with the Associated Press to put the record straight, because everyone else wants to talk to him. So there's a car chase through the streets of Los Angeles trying to get to this guy who looks completely bewildered. But of course, this will maybe be very clever. Act. I mean, maybe he is the founder of Bitcoin and he just doesn't look like we think the founder of Bitcoin should look.
And they're kind of sticking to their guns. They're sticking to their version of events, which is maybe the best damage control strategy. But what does it make you think, Oscar, on a sort of semi-serious note about journalism? Do you sort of shake your head and think, how have we come to this?
Look, all I can think of is that when Jon Stewart seems to have more journalistic integrity than the entire collected works of Rupert Murdoch, we are in trouble.
That's Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Stuart Purvis from City University, my guests today on the programme. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London,
Europe.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We're off to Copenhagen in a moment to tell what a couple of new surveys teach us about Danes and their habits. We'll delve into Franco's crypt and we'll head to the movies, as we like to do on Fridays. Before all of that, though, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley. He's got the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Russia has today accused the European Union of taking an extremely unconstructive position by freezing talks on easing visa barriers between Russia and the EU. With the European Union pressing for a negotiated solution to the crisis in Ukraine, Moscow has also now set out tough conditions it's indicated the West must take to win Russia's cooperation. The religious mix in cities in the Central African Republic must be maintained if the extremely grave situation in the country is to be stabilised, the UN's aid chief said on Friday. Following a visit to the conflict-torn country, Valerie Amos said fewer than 1,000 Muslims were believed to remain in the capital Bangui and that action had to be taken fast. A huge demonstration has taken place in Lisbon by police and security officials angry at wide-ranging wage cuts. Portugal has had to implement those cuts to overcome the financial crisis and meet its bailout terms. And the German president has expressed his sorrow and shame today for crimes committed by Nazi troops in Greece during the Second World War. Joachim Gauck visited Ioannina, where in October 1943, German Wehrmacht forces killed more than 90 people, including 34 children, and set fire to the homes. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Jonathan will be back, of course, with a full bulletin of world news for us at the top of the hour. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24, ticking along nicely towards 1900 in London. That'll be 1700 in Rio,
2000 in Copenhagen, which is where we head now, because we're going to speak to our man in the city. It's Michael Booth. Now, Michael, I was going to ask you what the Danes have been up to since the last time we spoke, but I gather you've got some new reports that can help you to tell us exactly that.
Yeah, Tom, actually, it's we now know more, I think, about the Danes in 2014 than we've ever known about them before, thanks to two very interesting reports about their habits and lifestyle, which have just been published. One of them was a health report, only the second one of its kind done. The first one was in 2010. And this new one questioned 162,000 Danes about their health. And some quite interesting results show that, for example, Danish women, they're not getting any sleep, but the men seem to be sleeping quite happily, whereas Danish men are quite fantastically over... No, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but they're a bit overweight, a bit porky, while the women are keeping in good shape. The men are smoking more than the women, but the women have fantastically high levels of stress compared to the men. So it's quite a mixed picture. In general, they're drinking a bit less and smoking a bit less, so I guess that's good. But there seems to be quite a big difference between the genders in Denmark.
Well, that is interesting, Michael, particularly that stress factor. And I don't know how much, I guess if the men are all morbidly obese, maybe that does provide quite a lot for women to worry about. But how surprised are you by that difference? Is it reflective of any other kind of cultural facets, perhaps, that you might notice?
Well, no, I was really, really surprised by the stress levels because Danes are famously relaxed and laid back, the women as much as the men, but this is one of the most famously equal societies in terms of gender, so I was quite surprised at the difference. I mean, in every age group, the women are more stressed than the men. I can't explain it, I'm afraid. I don't think anyone's tried to explain it yet. This report only just came out last week.
Well, there might be a clue, perhaps, Michael, in another survey of the sex lives of Danes, which I gather suggests that 30% of Danes in couples rates their sex lives below average. Well, I guess if the 30% is all made up of women, maybe that could be why they're so stressed out.
You know, Tom, I think there must be some picture we can tease out of all of this research, because, yeah, that's right. Megaphone did a poll recently about people in couples. For the newspaper Politiken, and it reveals that 18% of people in couples reveal their sex lives are under average or way under average. And as you say, every third one is unsatisfied with their sex life. And what is it? Quite a large percent, maybe 5%, are having sex fewer than once a month or something. It's quite a bleak picture for supposedly sexy Scandinavians.
Well, I was going to say, so in terms of cliche exploding, we're going somewhere. They're stressed out. They're not enjoying themselves in the bedroom. What's going on, Michael? How do you explain this?
Well, it's certainly not me. I'm in no way obese, and I'm not going to give you any details about my sex life. But luckily, they didn't ask me.
good stuff. Well, what else is happening in this sort of the season there? Obviously, it's probably still a pretty wintry. Is it pretty brisk? How do people spend their time? Do they? I gather there's a bit of bathing that goes on despite the potentially inclement conditions.
Yeah, this is quite an interesting new trend, and I've just observed it amongst friends of mine. More and more friends of mine in my age group are going winter bathing. Now, I couldn't think of anything worse to do on a brisk winter's morning than plunge into the sea. But about 25,000 people now belong to winter bathing clubs. This mostly happens in clubs. And that's up from about 19,000 a couple of years ago. And yeah, just as I say, empirical observation says lots of my friends are proudly boasting that every morning they go down to these almost zero temperature seas and plunge in, and I might add they're naked as well.
Holy mackerel. Well, I don't know what that would do for your sex life. Maybe it's a kill or cure, perhaps.
Yeah, again, I think there's something to be teased out from all of these. There's some connection here.
It is interesting, though, Michael, because we often talk about the weather and the effect that has on people's psyches. Obviously, you mentioned Scandinavian countries, the Nordic region. Yeah, it can be pretty brisk, and there's a lot of old cliches about how depressing it is with longer evenings and this sort of thing. But surely, in and around Copenhagen, that's not really a factor, is it? There's the cold weather. Do people get the sort of winter blues, do you think? And maybe that's why they plunge into these freezing seas.
Well, absolutely. You know, the winter, it's not necessarily about the cold. It's been quite a warm winter, actually. We've only had a little bit of snow. It's all about the darkness, Tom. The seasonal, what is it? The deficiency in vitamin D. Yeah, it really does affect even people who are born and bred here many generations. They still get the glums in the winter. And maybe that the winter bathing is one way to kind of fight against nature and say, you're not going to stop me. I'm going to have an invigorating experience regardless.
Good bracing stuff, as we'd say here in Blighty. Well, one other thing I suppose people might do, Michael, on a sort of those long, dingy, gloomy evenings, is retreat into their homes, curl up, watch a movie, maybe go to the cinema. And there's been a bit of a success in the Oscars, obviously, last weekend. Much fanfare greeted the big movies that everyone was expecting to do well, 12 Years a Slave, that the likes. But a slightly more unheralded success for Danish film.
Yeah, but it's in the short film category, fictional short film, I think it is. But they have an amazing track record in that category, the Danes. These two guys who won the Oscar last week, Anders Walter and Kim Magnussen, they've won it twice before or been involved with previous winners. Magnussen's dad won it in 2010. They kind of have ownership of that statuette in recent years. But the interesting thing is, despite all of these successes over the years, they didn't get any support from the Danish Film Institute. So there's been a bit of a self-analysis about this in the Danish media this week. Why aren't these people being supported better? They applied, but they were actually rejected.
Well, and what do you think, just briefly, Michael, do you think there's any prospect then that this will shake the establishment into reviewing it then, the Film Institute perhaps getting their musty wallets out and backing these talents a bit more readily?
Well, the Institute's been under quite a lot of criticism recently, but like everything in Denmark, it's public money that supports it, and that's being cut back. And the people are very frightened about the future of the Danish film industry, and it's been, you know, such a prestigious success for Denmark in recent years, beginning with Dogma and Lars von Trier, but also Susanne Bier winning Oscars. And, you know, it's one of Denmark's great soft power strengths. And there is a concern that it's being jeopardised by cuts and by accountants.
Well, we'll keep a weather eye on that one, Michael, and see if they sort out the situation. Now, that's Michael Booth, our Copenhagen correspondent. Michael, thanks very much for joining us, as always, on the programme. Up next, we'll be discussing Spain's lost memories from the Civil War onwards with Jeremy Treglown, author of Franco's Crypt. Stay tuned to find out more on Midori House.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, at 1842 here in London, and it is to Spain we go next on the programme, a country where the Franco regime and its aftermath has left a perhaps indelible impression on the nation's culture, on its very geography, and most crucially perhaps on its people. The very act of remembering the excesses of the Civil War, bitter divisions, the transition following the general's death in the 1970s is explored in a fascinating new book by the author and critic Jeremy Treglown, who I'm delighted to say joins me here in the studio. Jeremy, welcome to Midori House.
And thanks, Tom.
Good to have you with us. Let's talk a little bit about this idea of sort of reclaiming history. It's a key idea, a key strand of the book. Explain exactly why that's so fundamentally important in Spain.
For two reasons. One is that there's been an enormous campaign in Spain, rather politicized, saying that people weren't allowed to talk about what had happened under Franco for decades and that everything had been forgotten and needed to be recovered. That isn't true, and it's important to establish that it's not true. And how I've tried to establish it is by describing the role of the arts, particularly in acting as a repository of memory. And I think the people who've been saying all this stuff wasn't talked about, it's been forgotten, haven't read the books, haven't seen the movies that were coming out in the under Franco in the 50s and 60s, where there was a surprising degree of freedom for people to express the difficulties and complexities of the time they were living in.
Well, tell me a bit more about that, because there is that assumption, I guess it's understandable in some respects, that people often make about the sort of dearth of creativity and free expression, because they think, well, this is a repressive regime, it's going to stifle those expressions of it. It's far from the case, as you said. How did that work? Because I think it is probably unusual, to say the least, that it was such an exciting creative period.
I think it worked in a number of ways. One was that abstract art, which is very hard to pin down in terms of content, flourished enormously. You think about people like Tapies and Chiida and Antonio Saura. Another was that writers were surprisingly protected by people who, in the regime, who, although they were conservative in politics, actually had a very strong belief in artistic freedom. And who realized that the way to encourage it was not to censor it. So a lot was going on. In the cinema, it had to go on in a more coded way because people were watching what was happening more carefully. But one of the paradoxes is that some of the most interesting filmmakers of the Franco era, people like Antonio Saura's brother, Carlos Saura, and Patino, the documentary filmmaker, a number of others, García Berlanga, actually trained at a film school that was set up as the national film school under Franco, but then felt, well, okay, we need to find coded ways, including comedy, of saying what's really going on here.
And perhaps under that kind of pressure, you can almost express yourself even more elegantly than otherwise might be the case. Publishing in books, interesting, as you described. There's a chapter in the book, you talk a little bit about some examples. The Dictionary of National Biography recently published, and you say, you know, the natural thing to do is to turn through to the entry for Franco and see what you find. What did you find when you did that? How difficult is dealing with the legacy in that sort of respect?
Well, that's been a very controversial project. It's a huge project, and it's modelled on the British Dictionary of National Biography, which, of course, has been going on for a very long time now and where people have got used to working in certain ways. By the way, I should say in parentheses, it's a real pleasure to be on a radio programme where the person you're talking to has read the book. Thank you very much.
I try and do my best.
that book showed to me, because it emanates from a rather stuffy academy of history in Madrid, the ways in which the Franco-authoritarianism, male chauvinism have actually continued in certain professions. So it gave me a glimpse, although I've been talking about the ways in which people managed to get around the regime at the time, it gave me a glimpse too of the ways in which some of the fossilization that the regime introduced has continued. And there are an awful lot of old lizards out there who were educated under Franco and who are still espousing the idea that all the ideas of his regime.
From sort of publishing and books and those ideas, let's talk about some of the other expressions of it. Architecture, it's interesting, the crypts of the title, I suppose. You mention in the book, it's always a story of winners and losers when you're sort of documenting the spoils of a war. Is it right, do you think, is it inevitable that with that kind of history, there are, you know, the winners write the successes and the losers fall silent? Or is it slightly more complicated in this case?
Well, it's certainly more complicated in this case, partly because, I mean, Eric Hobsbawm, who was decidedly on the side of the Republic, said that this was a case where the loser story is the one that has prevailed. All the rest of the world wanted to hear, particularly from exiled writers, what they thought about what was going on. And there was a general sense, rightly, that the Franco regime was an undesirable thing happening in this peninsula on the south of Europe. At the same time, because of the Cold War and Franco's historical opposition to communism, there was a desire to protect it. So it was a very complicated situation. But generally speaking, we have, I think, the loser's view of the Civil War, and that has been romanticized by the appeal to American, British, French readers of the fact that volunteers from our countries went and fought on the Republican side and died. And I think that slightly occluded the complexities of the situation, because some of those people didn't really know very much about what they were fighting for or what was going on.
It's an interesting point you make there, and that, it strikes me that you mentioned that idea about a lot of the histories that people are perhaps most familiar with being written by external writers, these people from the United Kingdom or the United States, external influences, books in English. Do you find there was any irony that you then write a book in English about and it's been very well received by Spanish writers and critics as well. Is there a delicious irony, an extremely fair point,
and one that I'm very aware of. I think the excuse I make to myself is that I'm writing primarily for British readers. I'm very pleased that Spanish ones have looked at the book and on the whole found it to their liking. But I've wanted to say to my compatriots and to my American readers, look, we all know that Orwell wrote brilliantly about this war. We all know that Hemingway wrote brilliantly about this war. They really did. But what about the Spanish themselves? They wrote very well. And for decades, what they were writing and publishing and doing was mistrusted because they were doing it in Spain. And we thought, okay, well, we can forget about that. Well, there's an awful lot to read and life is short. But I hope I'm drawing attention to work which is very rewarding for British and American readers, and a lot of which now is either available in translation or coming out in translation. But I also think it's quite a good idea to learn Spanish and read some of those books in the language itself.
It's a good lesson to learn always. Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
That's Jeremy Tregán, his book Franco's Crypt, Spanish Culture and Memory Since 1936. It's published by Chatto and Windus, and it's out now in the UK. Time for a bit of music now, since we're in Spain. Let's have a Spanish singer-songwriter. This is Bebe with Siempre Me Quedara.
Han caído los esquemas de mi vida. Ahora que todo era perfecto y algo más que eso me sorbita.
That was the Spanish singer Bebe with Siempre Me Quedara. My apologies for butchering the Spanish language there. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Taking towards the top of the hour leaves us time for me to tell you what movies you should or perhaps shouldn't go to see this weekend and in the coming weeks. I'm delighted to be joined by the film critic Anna Smith. Anna, welcome to the programme. Let's kick off with Wes Anderson. I'm a fan. Where do you stand on his works today? He's got this new picture, The Grand Budapest Hotel, coming out.
I'm increasingly a fan, actually. Having seen this film, I revisited a lot of his earlier work. I enjoyed Fantastic Mr. Fox. I didn't think The Darjeeling Limited was very good. Tenenbaums was great. This, I think, is arguably his best so far. The main thing is it's really funny, OK? Ralph Fiennes, who knew, fantastic comedian, he plays this camp concierge of a hotel in the 1930s. You know, this being Wes Anderson's, it's a slightly alternative, very stylish version of the 1930s. And he's heading up this wonderful hotel between the walls. He gets into a spot of bother with the law, but remains polite throughout. He's one of those lovely old school hoteliers, you know, lost in his own world, kind of an ancient world. So he's great, great fun. And as usual, there's a ton of other colourful characters, beautifully clothed, walking symmetrically down the middle of staircases. It looks absolutely fantastic. And it gets faster and faster. It's kind of a caper that speeds up.
Good stuff. Well, I mean, he has a pretty singular vision, doesn't he, Wes Anderson? I always wonder, though, with these sorts of films where if you see this sort of promotional material, a huge cast of very impressive players, does it ever feel a bit like it's just a bit of a bragging ground, people just to turn up and do a bit of shtick and then move on? Or does it all hang together pretty effectively?
I think it works. I know what you mean. In a bad movie, I can get quite annoyed by those cameos just to show off how many famous friends people have. But we all know that Bill Murray and Owen Wilson and so on work regularly with Wes Anderson, and we know that he enjoys having his regulars back on board. And it's almost like a little cheer goes through the audience with the fans when they see those guys popping in. So I think it works.
Let's take a very quick listen to a bit of Grand Budapest Hotel. Here it is.
I love you.
I love you. She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
This was also when I met Agatha.
She's charming. She's so charming.
Is he flirting with you?
Yes.
Now, one thing I like about Wes Anderson is it is fun. You mentioned this movie. Ralph manages to deliver a pretty good comedy turn. He doesn't dress it up too much. It's good. Is it good, honest? Is it a comedy, pure and simple?
No, it's a bit more complex than that, to be honest. I mean, dark things do happen, but what's interesting is they generally happen off screen. So it's more that he keeps the tone resolutely light despite the darkness of the content. You know, this is a wartime almost film, and, you know, bad things do happen, but he still leaves you with a smile on your face. There is that lovely light tone.
good news. Let's talk a little bit about The Stag. Now, how would you describe this? Is this a genre movie, perhaps?
Well, it is a genre, I suppose, in terms of The Hangover, you know, movies about stag parties where terrible things happen, you know, all boys together. The difference with this one, which I liked in principle, is it's a metrosexual stag party. So there's a guy who's very in touch with his feelings, doesn't really like going boozing with the guys, forced to go on a stag night with various friends, including gay friends. But what they throw into the mix is the bride's brother, who's very, very testosterone-fueled guy. So it's about the culture clash between them. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. And what you need here is great characters, really solid acting, and there's very little of that. The standout here is Andrew Scott, who played Moriarty in Sherlock, and he's terrific as the best man. But the groom is very hard to like, so it's a bit of a problem.
Oh dear, and who's responsible for The Stag then? Who do we blame?
This is an Irish film, and Peter MacDonald is a name you might recognise, and he's co-scripted and he stars in it as well. So and it's a debut director, so you know we should cut him a bit of slack.
So some promising kernels of ideas, but not quite delivered. Let's talk a little bit about Under the Skin. Now, this is intriguing to me. Jonathan Glazer, who's had kind of an interesting career making movies, making music videos, commercials, this kind of thing. I guess people will know him probably best for Sexy Beasts, but quite a long time. He's returned to the big screen. What's he brought us?
He did Birth before that with Nicole Kidman, which was a quite surreal, unusual film. If you thought that was surreal, this is something else. Under the Skin is a bizarre film. It's very loosely based on a Michelle Faber book about an alien that comes to Earth in beautiful female form, sort of femme fatale, seduces men literally kind of absorbs them under her skin for nefarious purposes. Scarlett Johansson plays this woman, and they actually filmed it on the streets of Glasgow with her sort of, the film crew in the back of a white van, and she was driving around picking up real Glaswegian guys, so they film the actual reaction. So it's quite fascinating. There's a sense of realism there, but then of course, this being Jonathan Glazer, it gets totally bonkers.
Well, I was going to say, I know it's very sort of well acted. It does sound rather challenging. Is it one where, is this a movie you can go to of an evening, and is it a bit of escapism? Is it almost too challenging for that?
It's very challenging. You have to be in a strong mood because it's very intense. It's visually intense. The sound is intense. There's very little dialogue. It is very much an art house film, and it's probably his most obscure film to date, but I enjoyed it.
Just briefly on this, are you sort of surprised by the trajectory of Glazer's career? Because, I mean, Sexy Beast had some bravura touches, but there was a pretty straightforward narrative. It was a fairly easy to follow movie. Surprised by how he's charted his course?
I am. I don't know him, but I say it's an unusual move to get less and less mainstream. Yeah.
Well, maybe we should celebrate that.
Good for him.
Absolutely. Anna Smith, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House to guide us through the week's big releases. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to my special guests, Oscar Guardiola-Rivera and Stuart Purvis, and to Anna, of course. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Next up's The Menu with Marcus Hippi, 2200 Hours The Monocle Daily with Emma and Andrew. We'll be back with the show at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 Hours London Time, as if you needed reminding. But that's all for this Friday edition of Midori House. From me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.